This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Colin Liddell from Alternative Right. Colin, it's a great talking to you.
Hi, Robert. It's great to be back.
So we'll be focusing on tonight's show on the event in Paris. You've done a number of different articles on this topic.
Yes, definitely. It's very much in the news, and so I think it's a good time to sort of write about the event, but also not just the event, but a lot of the issues that are related to it. You know, a lot of issues that would normally be kind of ignored or swept under the carpet.
Yeah, I notice with these types of events, people will go on about the tragedy itself, and they'll say things like, pray for the victims, and like everyone has like their French flag up on Facebook. So they'll do stuff like that, but people tend to just sort of focus just on that element. They don't really want to get to the deeper issues that
lead to an
event like this.
Of course not, because they haven't been focused on the deeper issues anyway, so why would they suddenly want to go there? You know what I mean? But this actually gives people in our sort of neck of the woods a chance to push some of these issues into the foreground. So sometimes, you know, in the alternative right, when these things happen, which, you know, of course we tend to expect these kind of things to happen a lot, and we expect them to increase happening. And when they happen, and we write about them, and then we actually use them to foreground some of the issues that we want people to focus on, you sometimes feel a little bit opportunistic and a little bit sleazy doing that. But I think there's no real alternative to, you know, you have to do that.
Yeah, whenever there's like a tragedy, I mean, it's kind of hard not to come across as sleazy. People always have their own angle to events like this. I mean, people say this person's exploiting this event, but I mean, yeah, people do exploit tragedies, but it's very important to talk about the root cause.
Yeah, well, I mean, the left, of course, they're particularly adept at exploiting any tragedy, except they put a completely wrong analysis on everything. Whereas, you know, we try to, instead of exploiting the tragedy, we just try to, you know, explain the underlying factors and the, you know, feasible and reasonable solutions.
I mean, if you go back in history and you look at what happened with 9/11, first of all, 9/11 is a very different situation than this, because France and Europe has a huge, massive Muslim invasion. In the United States, the Muslim population is relatively small, and the 9/11 hijackers they had no roots in this country. They came here fairly recently on visas. Most of them were Saudis. And 9/11 was definitely exploited by the neocons. They pushed for these wars in the Middle East. They pushed for curtailing on civil liberties, spying on American citizens.
Yeah.
They did absolutely nothing to actually secure our borders under Bush. I mean, Bush actually dramatically increased the number of student visas to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
So it was exploited in a terrible way.
Well, those neoconservatives, they were basically, from our perspective, operating within a kind of leftist framework. And they thought that by kicking out the bad guys, they could radically reform these countries and turn them into versions of the West. And, of course, people in the alternative right would never subscribe to those kind of ridiculous ideas. But that's a very kind of leftist mindset. So the neocons were basically just another variety of leftists. And, you know, like all leftists, they have an unreal analysis and viewpoint on how the world works. And so naturally they ran into all sorts of difficulties. And I think they still haven't fully recovered from that.
And their actions in the Middle East led to the creation of ISIS and the whole sort of migrant crisis that we're seeing right now. I mean, ISIS got its start in Iraq, And
yeah, I just like to say that the migrant crisis, I tend to view the migrant crisis has been in existence for several decades now.
Well, it's gotten a lot worse due to the wars, but it's been going on a long time.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a combination of both economic migrants and people fleeing a war. It's both.
Yeah, well, it's a combination of a lot of factors, but I think probably the main factor is it's an internal Western factor, and I think the problem there is we have developed a kind of negative culture, you know, one that is defined by freedoms and a lack of positive identity, and so therefore that leaves us wide open to colonization by other cultural and civilizational groups.
And that's basically what your recent article is about, Paris and the failure of cultural death camps. Before I get to that, I want to look at the terrorists themselves. So with the terrorists, one of them actually did come in as a refugee, but the main one actually didn't come in recently as a refugee. He was born in Belgium, and his parents were immigrants from Morocco.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he's been described as a Belgian, much to the kind of confusion and befuddlement of the masses. Yeah, but this just shows the failure to, assimilate. Assimilation is not as easy as people think, especially when you're coming from a crude positive culture like Islam, and you're trying to relocate to a kind of negative, anything-goes kind of culture like the West. Which doesn't really give people like that any kind of identity. So the idea of Muslims assimilating to the West, I think it's actually pretty absurd.
I mean, when you lived in London, what has been your observations? Do a lot of Muslim immigrants sort of assimilate into sort of Western hedonism? I know a lot of them adopt kind of, they emulate sort of like Black American gangster culture. Do you see that a lot?
Well, you see the bits of that, but the idea that that Muslims are all these wonderful paragons of virtue anyway is absurd. Their culture is actually very, very kind of hedonistic in certain ways, and there's a lot of drug taking, there's a lot of buggery, and there's all sorts of things going on that would not really be acceptable in most kind of traditional Christian societies.
Well, there's definitely, there's a lot of hypocrisy. With the religion, a lot of them are not very pious, but they use sort of their religion more as an identity.
Yeah, they're a bit like kind of Catholics on steroids, you know what I mean? So you always have this kind of this tortured Catholic identity where people sin and then they feel guilty about it. And with Muslims, you see some similar pattern where they're very pious about certain aspects of their religious identity, but at the same time, they're very, very hedonistic in other ways.
So your article, The Cultural Death Camps of the West, it's not so much, the focus isn't really on Islam per se, but it's about how Western culture has become.
Well, I would say it's mainly about the what happens when Islam meets Western culture. And, I think there was the assumption, and, there was some basis for these assumptions. I mean, there's always bases for these assumptions. And then they later turn out to be unfounded. But in that case, the European leaders, the Western leaders, when they were setting in motion the forces that would lead to the multicultural state, there were certain assumptions that they had, and they thought that we were moving away from traditional religion. We're moving into a more modernist world where people were much more focused on material things. And, in the 1950s and 60s, that was very, very much the case. Islam seemed to be declining as a cultural force. Most of the Arab and Islamic nations were moving strongly towards secularism, and that's why you had people like Saddam Hussein and Nasser and the Assad clan in power. They were all kind of like secular Arabs, national socialists. And, you know, the assumption was that you could then also allow lots of people from those countries to come into Europe. And, you know, once they encountered European culture and European society, they would soon realize how absurd and ridiculous their Islamic culture and identity was, and that they would then quickly assimilate. And these were all the kind of the wild assumptions upon which this whole thing was based. And, you know, of course, now we realize, or a lot more people realize, that this is this was a complete piece of nonsense. You know, Arabs came to the West, all these various Muslims from various Muslim countries like Pakistan and other places came to the West. But they were not, they have not been westernized, and they're not about to be westernized.
I know you have this picture, it says leftist fantasy culture as cosplay, and you show this woman like she's half in a burqa, but the bottom half of her is nude. And obviously, yeah. That picture would be offensive to a lot of Muslims, but you're kind of saying it's kind of symbolic of the contradiction of the two forces in conflict with each other.
Yeah, well, I think this is the whole connected to the whole leftist mindset. And you know, another thing that leftists are fond of saying is that race is only skin deep. Maybe the numbers are diminishing, you know, because they're not breeding and because they're actually losing faith in this idea. But a lot of them still believe that. They actually believe that, oh, you know, people might look different, but that's the only difference, and that treated in the same way, you'll get similar results. And they have a similar view towards cultures, I think. So they see Islamic culture has a funny costume and a few items on a menu, and they don't realize it runs a lot deeper, and it really shapes the whole psychology and the culture, and it's something that gets passed on from generation to generation. And even when people immigrate to different cultures and societies, it takes a very, very long time to break it down. And actually, it's a lot harder to break down these original cultures nowadays than it was like 100 years ago. Like 100 years ago, when people emigrated to America, they would be forced to assimilate because they would have no means of staying in touch with their home culture. And so they would become American. And, of course, they're starting from a point which is much closer to American culture anyway. But nowadays we have people from the third world who are coming to the developed countries, and they're forming their own ghettos, their own communities, because there's so many of them. And then they're in daily contact with the people back home through the internet and through modern technology. So, you know, those people, the rate of assimilation, if there ever was such a thing with Muslims, is like falling off a cliff.
And even if you look at a group like the Gypsies, I mean, they've been in Europe since, I think they've been in Europe like 1,000 years, but they're still they still have a very different identity.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you notice that when you travel around the world and live in different countries. And, you know, when I lived in Scotland, I didn't go around thinking I'm Scottish every day. But, you know, as soon as I moved down to London, I started to become a bit more conscious of it. And then, you know, like when I moved to Japan, then I started to become very conscious that I'm a white person. You know what I mean? So those things have a very big impact as well.
So basically the theme of your article is kind of cultural genocide, that wiping out a people's culture is a lot more effective than actual physical genocide, than mass murder.
Well, I'm not sure if it's more effective, because I think the point I make is that it's actually quite hard to do, and it would actually physically be easier to wipe them out as a people. I'm not advocating that, but I'm saying...
Well, no, what you're saying is you're talking about... The premise of your article is more about how Europeans have sort of lost touch of sort of an organic culture, and they just have kind of like hedonism and consumerism, and that's especially in the case of America. I mean, Europe has a lot of the same issues where a a lot of people just sort of are hedonistic and consumeristic.
Mm.
But in the same sense, they still have some, they still have some kind of connection to a culture. When a lot of, with a lot of Americans, that's basically like all they have.
By connection to a culture, what are you referring to, for example?
Well, I mean, if you go to Europe, I mean, people have, you have areas where people have lived there for in the same area for hundreds of years. They have like the same regional cuisine, regional music, distinct like architecture. They still have a, there's plenty of places in Europe where they have a very strong attachment to their country and region.
Yeah.
A lot of Americans.
Yeah.
They don't really have that much of an identity. They just sort of have consumerism.
Yeah, well, in Europe, the identities are much more deeply rooted and organic. But also at the same time, you know, we've been swept up by this greater rootless Western culture, which is, you know, sort of centered on the Anglo world, especially America. And in the case of Americans, they've kind of they've lost a lot of their ethnic identity, and they've been left with a kind of rather awkward racial identity, which a lot of them don't seem to be very comfortable with. And it's kind of hard to maybe have a racial identity, because most cultural elements have an ethnic character, and so that puts a lot of Americans in a very awkward position. And I guess groups like the Jews, you know, they still have an ethnic identity, and so that puts them in a stronger position.
So you're making the point that the establishment in Europe is trying to win over these young men who are coming over with pleasures of the hedonistic West, like sports and pornography on the internet. But that's obviously not going to be, I don't think it's going to be effective.
Yeah, I mean, they, one of the points I make in the article is that Western leftists and liberals are actually de facto Christian supremacists, because they have the assumption that Christianity was, you know, is and was a much more high-level faith system that was harder for them to break down. But when they see Islam, because Islam ostensibly has a lot of ridiculous elements to Western people. I mean, when you actually read the Quran and you see some of the outlandish things that it contains, and some of the behaviors that Muslims are encouraged to participate in, it does have a kind of ridiculous appearance to many Westerners. But this is very illusionary and delusive, and it's actually very cleverly calibrated to maintain a strong grip on the minds of its believers. And so when these people come to the West, first of all, there's several things going on. They're in a foreign country, so they therefore feel their own identity much more strongly, which is something that anybody feels when they go to a foreign country. But also they have because they tend to be at the bottom of society, they have a very marked inferiority complex. And of course, psychologically, people don't like to feel inferior. They you know, if people are inferior, they'll strive to find some way to feel superior. Now, if you're an underpaid Muslim migrant or a Muslim migrant living on welfare, then there's certain ways you can cope with this inferiority syndrome. You know, one way is you could like rape a local woman. And that gives you a sense of superiority over the locals. Another way you can do that is you can believe that your religion or your group is superior in some transcendent sense. Like these people are infidels. We are the true believers of Allah. You know, so that gives you a sense of superiority. So the act of these people coming to the West actually pushes them into very dangerous psychological territory.
So in a sense, European Muslims are a lot more radical than Muslims in Muslim countries.
Yeah, they have a psychological predisposition to be like that. I mean, with the first generation of Muslims in any country, they tend to still be kind of comparing themselves to the people back home. So, like, you know, if you look at the history of France, when the Algerians started to come over, a lot of the Algerians were kind of like keen to semi-assimilate. And they, you know, their sense of pride was that, oh, we've made it into this affluent country and we're getting quite well paid. And, you know, they were comparing themselves directly with the people back in their home villages. And, you know, that made them look good. So they had a vested interest in this sort of loose French identity. But has their links to their hometowns withered and disappeared, then they had less of a reason to identify quite as strongly with their new cult, their new society, the French society. And then they started to feel that they were at the bottom of the heap, and they felt this sense of inferiority. And then therefore they felt the way out of this was to be antagonistic in some way to French culture.
What has been the situation like with... you also talk about people who have came from the West Indies. I mean, they're obviously not Muslim, but you have seen a lot of the same trends.
I think with in London, because, you know, I lived in London for several years, and I was very aware of the various groups down there. The with the West Indians, there's a certain similar sense. They're seeking some kind of they're seeking to counter their sense of cultural inferiority through sexual prowess by, you know, scoring with the local woman. And but
also, are you talking about a rape or just regular sex?
Both. And then also there is a kind of religious aspect, because a lot of the young West Indian men, and these would be the people in the culture who feel this sense of inferiority most keenly, a lot of those young West Indian men, they were then attracted to Rastafarianism, which is a, you know, this weird kind of Afrocentric religion. Young black women in London were less attracted to that, because as women, they have less of a need to feel superior. But young men have a kind of there's a hardwired psychological need to have to be dominant and to have a sense of pride, and all men have this to some degree. And so you see how these patterns impact differently on different genders, and you can see what's driving it in both cases. And so there are interesting parallels between West Indians and Muslims living in a Western society.
I mean, in the United States, there's an interesting situation. In Europe, people tend to kind of associate being Arab with Muslim. In the United States, it's a very complex situation. I mean, traditionally, most Arab Americans have been Christian. On the other hand, most Muslims in America, a large portion of them are like blacks who convert to Islam in prison, but also there's a lot of Somalis. So the United States is a little bit different situation than
Europe. That's interesting about the rise of black Islam, because again, that's a way of coping with a sense of inferiority, I think. You're putting yourself in the position of being the chosen group, and everybody else, who you felt inferior to previously, being infidels.
And there's even been cases of young white men converting to Islam because young men are looking for a way to feel powerful, and I guess modern day Christianity doesn't really like offer that.
Yeah, and especially young working class men are kind of being gradually pushed to the bottom of the heap in many societies because of all these efforts to make the other marginalized groups feel part of society. Most of that is sort of leveraged off young working class white males, and so they're the ones in the future who are going to be having the issues with feeling inferior.
And this kind of ties in with your Black Pill article, which I want to get to. I mean, young white men who feel the same way, they don't really have the same outlet. Like in America, blacks and Mexicans have the gang culture. Mm. I guess the closest, I mean, there you have had some young white men going like spree shootings. And yeah, that comes from that same sense of feeling inferior and wanting to prove yourself. But that's something that's done, like, on an individual basis. But there's not so much... With radical Islam, it's about being part of a group and feeling a sense of power.
Yeah, I also wrote another article quite recently, LARPing the Caliphate at Radix. Have you seen that?
Yes, I did. You talk about the Boko Haram in Africa.
Yeah, but it's mainly about ISIS and the way that ISIS are, they're actually playing a role which is much more powerful than they are. And, you know, by a kind of weird kind of group of factors, they're actually in a position to do that, you know, because ISIS is, in the article, the point I make is that ISIS is actually a very weak group. And the only reason they can exist is because all the other people who are involved in the Syrian and the Syrian conflict and the Iraq conflict are very undecided. They can't agree, and so you have all these various forces kind of counterbalancing each other: the Saudis, the Turks, the Israelis, the Iranians, the Russians, the Americans, and so that creates a kind of gray space in which a group like ISIS can exist. And, under normal conditions, they would just be wiped out. You know, at some level, they are aware of their inferiority and weakness. But instead of admitting that and sort of toning down their behavior and rhetoric, they go in the opposite direction and they start trying to play this kind of fantasy role of the caliphate, of being these Islamic strongmen, of being able to do anything they want without reference to the feelings and concerns of other people.
One thing I did read about, I heard about this on NPR, which is interesting, is a lot of the men joining ISIS actually are not necessarily from the proletariat. This is in Tunisia.
Yeah.
And Tunisia has traditionally been one of the more like moderate or advanced Arab countries. But because they had a growing middle class, what's happening is you have a lot of men from the middle class who get college degrees, but they can't find employment. So a lot of them are going off to joining ISIS.
Well, yeah, that's a good example.
I don't think necessarily that religion's the main motivation.
No, far from it.
I think it's wanting to be part of a group and to feel powerful.
Yes, it's interesting that you mentioned middle-class Muslims being radicalized, because this is a pattern that's been noticed by other people, and there's been several articles about it. And, a middle-class Muslim, somebody from a reasonably well-off family, somebody who's well-educated, but most Islamic societies are quite dysfunctional by Western standards. And so even if you're from a good family and you're well-educated, you're going to have young men are going to have problems getting ahead. And so there will be issues of status, which, many young men might seek to solve by joining a group like ISIS, which is psychologically designed to make its members feel better about themselves.
Especially the way that the news plays up ISIS. The news definitely puts ISIS out like it's the most... They basically make it like it's the equivalent of Nazi Germany today.
Yeah, I think that's partly because of ISIS themselves, because they've actually evolved an approach which is designed to feed off the news media, and almost everything they do. I mean, to us, it just looks like, I mean, not to us, but to most people, it just looks like inexplicably barbaric, loathsome behavior. And, actually, yes, it is. But also there is a kind of logic behind it. And the logic behind it is they do everything because they know they have to shock the media. And by shocking the media, they get coverage. And by getting coverage, they get power. And so, they're actually trolling the world's media.
Yeah, I mean, with ISIS, if you look at Al-Qaeda, they were very specific in their objectives and their targets. With ISIS, they seem to just kind of want to cause destruction and chaos just for the sake of causing destruction and chaos.
That's what it looks like. But of course, they're operating within a very kind of media savvy framework. And they know that you know, if they're going to make the 9 o'clock news, they're going to have to burn a cage full of children or have synchronated gays thrown off the roofs of tall buildings or whatever. You know what I mean? So they're just thinking, how can we refine this? How can we find a new depth, a new depravity of cruelty that will make this video go viral, or which will shock this media company to report on us?
One thing that is interesting comparing ISIS and Al-Qaeda, I know ISIS has destroyed a lot of ancient sites in Syria and Iraq, the most famous one being the ancient Greek city of Palmyra in Syria, but also ancient Babylonian sites in Iraq.
Yeah.
But what's interesting and fascinating is the 9/11 hijacker, Muhammad Atta. He actually studied archaeology in Syria, mm-hmm. and he was primarily appalled by seeing, like, American consumerism, like McDonald's, spreading to Syria.
Mm-hmm.
I see him as being a lot more intellectual and sophisticated in comparison to ISIS. I mean, ISIS are just, as I said, they just want to destroy just for the sake of destroying.
No, that's not true. They want to destroy for the sake of shocking the West and then getting this amplification through our media. They're using our media to amplify their image so that naive, low IQ Muslims will think that they are Osama bin Laden's strong horse. I mean, this is what it's all about. You know, it's about seeming to be powerful. And, you know, this Muhammad Atta person you're talking about, he sounds much more like a kind of a transitional figure as well, because, you know, Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athists, at one point, they were very much into preserving and taking pride in Iraq's archaeology, its ancient culture, the Assyrian Empire, stuff like that. And all
I was talking on a previous show, I was talking to my friend Charles Lincoln, and he actually worked as a archaeologist in Iraq, and he said back at the time the Iraqi government was incredibly friendly to archaeology.
That's true, because in those days archaeology reflected well on the regime, the Iraqi regime. It made archaeology was making the point that this is the one of the centers of civilization, and so of course the secular socialist nationalist Ba'athist government could then use that to put a feather in its cap, so to speak. And then when the Ba'athist regime was kicked out, and you had all these high-ranking Sunni Arab Muslims kicked out of their comfortable positions, they then started to fight back through this kind of insurrection in the Sunni provinces, and that's what later flowed into the creation of ISIS. So a lot of the top people in ISIS are actually old Ba'athists who actually have a secular background, and who 20 years ago would be taking great pride in Iraq's archaeological riches, but who are now prepared in the interests of gaining publicity to destroy some of the same things.
So this other article that you wrote a while back is called The Black Pill.
Yeah.
And this definitely, you do reference ISIS in this article. But to start off with, you say that the two pills being discussed are the red pill and the blue pill. Before you get to the black pill, basically the blue pill means those are the people who are just kind of conformist and they go along with what society tells them.
Yes, right, yes. The people who just want a quiet life and who want to feel superior even though they're losing their superiority.
And then you describe the red pill as people who reject the values of mainstream society. You mentioned basically like identitarians.
The one way of looking at the red pill people is they're more realistic. They realize what the situation is, and they're also more forward looking. And so they see that things are moving in a direction that is detrimental to them. And now while the people who take the blue pill, they can feel safe and secure because they're able to look backwards instead of looking forwards. But the people who feel inclined to take the red pill, they're more focused on the future. And so they can see that actually, you know, we're going to be reduced to a minority, and our children are going to be part of an even smaller minority. And, you know, we're going to be, you know, in some form or other wiped out, either as a group or a culture. And so they see that lumen inferiority. And so then they think, how can I counteract that? How can I fight against that?
So with the black pill is basically like pure egoism, nihilism, and destruction. You say that it leads to suicide and death and violence. But I think in a lot of cases, I think a lot of people, they start off as blue pill, mm-hmm. and they discover the red pill. But they feel that once they discover the red pill, they feel that things are hopeless and there's nothing positive they can do for a change. Yeah. And from there, they go to the black pill.
That seems to be quite a logical trajectory for a lot of people. But also, I kind of incorporated into this framework the idea of alpha and beta males as well. In this schemata, I tend to see the red pillars as people who are seeking to be genuine alphas. They're seeking to improve themselves, they're seeking to resist, they're seeking to fight, and you know, they accept the idea that they might be defeated, but that doesn't mean that they, you know, they can't fight. I mean, because in a sense, just to fight is a way to win, and to not fight is a way to, you know, inevitably lose. And so I think the ideas of this concept of alpha and beta is also important. Now, with the black pill people, I'd say that they tend to be more irredeemably beta, and so it's quite hard for them to follow the path of the red pill, because they don't have that true alpha quality. And now, for betas, the only paths that lie open are passivity or destruction. That's all they're capable of. Now, true alphas can actually construct something positive. Now, the blue pillars, they're kind of like false alphas. They have this psychological need to feel important, but they prefer to act this out through illusion, which is a form of alpha decadence.
You're talking about the people who have status within the society as it is, but basically are loyal to society, and they're basically blue pill.
Yeah, yes. So the people who have status and who accept the status quo, and who prefer to look backwards and to use illusion rather than looking at the grim realities which we are all facing. So in a way, the black pillars, they're more forward looking. They're more forward looking than the blue pillars, but that's part of the problem. You know, because they're looking forward, they can see how fucked up society really is, and how fucked up their situation is, and how they're never going to be able to do anything significant. So I think most black pillars, the kind of healthy, sensible course for those people would be to lap into passivity.
Well, I think for people for red pill people to be successful, they have to be with a strong, cohesive group with other people who think the same way that they are. For someone who is kind of basically on their own and they're not part of a group, you can't really be red pill. It's very easy to get into the black pill if you're just on your own and you don't have like a group shares your values.
I think the way to solve this conundrum is to have more hierarchy. And so you can have a hierarchy between the red pillars and the black pillars. So the black pillars, who are natural betas, who are only capable of obedience, passivity, or destruction, they could be good foot soldiers for the red pillars.
So this was actually you wrote this in response to a school shooting in America.
Yeah, the one in Oregon. I forget the killer's name. He was this mulatto, I think, and he was This was one of those stories that didn't quite fit the narrative, and so it was very quickly dropped down the memory hole, unlike Dylan Roof Stormer and other similar incidents. But there was a lot of interesting things that that came up in the immediate aftermath of that case, and but now that case has been quickly lost from view.
Do you have school shootings in England and Europe, or is it mostly just an American phenomenon?
Well, we have less of an availability of guns, but there have been similar incidents from time to time. Yeah, there was a famous case back in, when was it, back in the 90s, I think, in Scotland, where this killer went to a school and I think he shot about 20 kids. He was a bit of a gun nut, a bit of a loner type as usual. But that's probably quite an interesting case to look at.
And then also I was mentioning with men who join ISIS in Tunisia, a lot of them are from the middle class. Mm-hmm. A lot of these, like, spree shooter types in America, they tend to be from middle-class backgrounds because they're kind of brought up. Well, yeah. First of all, most of them are, they tend to be loners and socially isolated. But the other thing is they're brought up in a middle-class background and they're brought up to think that they will succeed. Mm-hmm. But in America, that the middle class is being decimated. So they're seeing no opportunities in front of them, and yeah. They see their life as being hopeless, no job opportunities, no chance at having a girlfriend, getting married, starting a family.
Yeah. So they basically take a
purely nihilistic outlook, and they feel that things are hopeless, so they strike out.
Yeah. They're in an interesting position in a way because they're. They're in that kind of beta zone and that kind of black pill zone, but they're kind of near enough to the alpha and red pill zone to kind of become agitated. So if they were like lower down that spectrum, lower down the black spectrum, they would then just lapse into, you know, drug taking and couch potatoism and just becoming general morons or lard asses or whatever. But because they're kind of near enough to the red pill zone and the alpha zone, that kind of makes them more agitated, and so they're at some point they kind of maybe aspire to be red pill, but then they realize that involves too much intelligence, too much self discipline, too much hard work, and so then they then go into a kind of downward spiral from that. And that might be something that could maybe trigger them psychologically into this much more aggressive, but also nihilistic behavior. Because I mean, there is a kind of alpha element in being hyper violent like that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember one of the famous shooters. What's his name? His name was Elliot Rodger. He actually, in his videos, he actually said, "I am the ultimate alpha male."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's a perfect example of what I just mentioned.
And same with, like, a lot of these individuals, they're exposed to the red pill. I mean, some people are trying, when that specific one I was talking about, I know the reaction of the Manosphere types was to say that shooter, Elliot Rodger, was actually blue pill, but I don't agree with that. I think he was exposed to a lot of...
How did they say that, though? Why did they say he was blue pill?
Well, the mainstream media was saying that he was being influenced by pickup artists and the Manosphere. So their immediate reaction was to say that he was actually blue pill and he was a male feminist.
Oh, I see. So being into PUA is a form of blue pill. It's a form of just like going with the flow.
But basically with these individuals, they're exposed to the red pill, but they just can't succeed, so they turn to the black pill. And you have this video, you have this YouTube video by some guy named the Eggman.
Yeah.
That was
well worth watching.
So this video, did it have, it had some connection to the Oregon shooting,
Yeah, a lot of people said that he was the shooter at first.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
There were a lot of, you know, because now we live in an increasingly troll-like culture. So whenever these events happen now, people immediately jump on them and start trolling them, and they start to throw in all sorts of weird narratives. And one of the ideas that that surfaced was that this guy, the Eggman, I think he is some sort of minor personality on YouTube, and that some people suggested that he might be the shooter. And I think a lot of people kind of bought that at first. I remember, I think Andy Nowicki on our site, he kind of went along with that for a while, you know. So, but it sort of proved to be quite interesting anyway.
So yeah, you make those comparisons in your articles. You talk about white nationalism and Dylann Roof, the manosphere affections of Elliot Rodger.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at Dylann Roof, I mean, he was exposed to white nationalism, but the key thing is he didn't have any kind of healthy community that he was part of.
Yeah, and also he only had a very tenuous grip on white nationalism because, I mean, assuming he's a real person and that all these conspiracy theories are just like, you know, kind of tinfoil hat theories, his grasp of white nationalism was rather shaky because he seemed to think that Ian Smith was a great white nationalist hero.
So if you compare these loner kind of spree shooter types with radical Islam, Muslim culture is much more clannish.
Yeah.
They tend to act in groups, but there definitely are a lot of like similarities if you compare the psychology.
Yeah, well, in a way, our society is just much more atomized than theirs. I mean, we used to have a certain degree of clannishness as well. And we've just been, you know, subjected to the forces of modernism much more. And so we've kind of lost that. And I think there is a kind of biological basis for that to happen to us more easily than it is for that to happen to them. Because I think, you know, the recent RADx conference, Dr. McDonald was making a presentation about differences between whites and other groups, and one of the marked differences is that we evolved in a much more sparsely populated environment, and so we have not developed this kind of strong group competitiveness instinct that other groups have. I mean, because Arabs, and other southern races, they evolved in a much more densely populated environment, and so it was much more important to struggle against other groups. Whereas we evolved in a much less densely populated area, so our main challenge was to struggle against the environment, and so therefore we tended to be more cooperative, and we were more accustomed to accepting strangers based on merit.
And especially like a place, especially Northern Europe. I mean, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure the Mediterranean, like ancient Rome and Greece, those places were much more dense.
Yeah. I mean, you can see this division in Europe as well. The you know, the southern groups tend to be much more clannish than somewhere like Sweden, where anybody can walk in the door and, you know, say a few words of Swedish and they're immediately accepted as a fully signed up member of Sweden.
So you wrote this article on Countercurrents called Sound is a Pound, and this is about this movement called Casa Pound in Italy.
Yeah, that article actually has an interest in history because, you know, that article was written a few years ago. At the time, I was going to do an article for the Quarterly Review, which was a paper publication that was based out of England, and for various reasons the article didn't see the light of day, and it was just like knocking around on my desktop for a while, and I had a chance to look at it again, and I thought, oh, this is actually, you know, quite a good read. So I sent it to Craig Johnson at Countercurrents, and he agreed to publish it. So it's actually an article written about 3 or 4 years ago.
Did you ever interview anyone from Casa Pound, their leader, Gianluca Ione?
Yeah, I interviewed Mr. Iannone by email. And so the quotes in the article are all from that email correspondence.
So basically their origins was there was a group of Italian nationalists squatting in Rome's Esquilino neighborhood in 2003.
Yeah.
And a bunch of families took over government-owned buildings in Rome's Chinatown to protest rents being too high.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about Casa Pound is, Casa Pound, they're not actually making enormous headwaves in Italy, because in Italy the voters have quite a lot of options. I mean, like if you're an Italian voter and you're not too pleased with the status quo, there are quite a lot of radical options for you to choose from. I mean, parties like the Northern League, they attract millions of voters, and they're quite a radical semi-nationalist grouping. And so, with Casa Pound, they're maybe a little bit too esoteric for most voters. But the interesting thing about Casa Pound is that they have this form of communitarianism or nationalism, and then they try to create it in the real world. So I thought that kind of contrast is interesting, because, like, especially in the Anglo world, and especially in America, white nationalism is still very much a kind of online phenomenon. And, there's very little IRL nationalism in America. It's all kind of like websites or Twitter accounts or trolling people, etc. And it's almost like the internet's a great way for people to vent, that's also quite dangerous in itself, because it allows people to let off steam without actually doing anything concrete. So I really think that in the case of America, because in America there is a very large group of people who are very, very energized and excited about nationalism, but they're not really doing that much about it in the real world. You have sites like the Daily Stormer. I recently had a bit of a fracas with them, as usual, and they seem to be quite a popular site. They seem to have millions of hits, but what do they achieve with that in the real world? It's a purely online phenomenon, and to me that is highly suspicious. It almost suggests some kind of control mechanism to me. Because if you have all that kind of nationalist fervor and you have all these people who strongly believe this, then it should be manifesting itself in the real world as a kind of organic logic that pushes, this kind of mass movement on the internet into the real world. You can see cases like, in Europe, in Germany even, you have a movement like Pegida, and they organize street demonstrations numbering in the tens of thousands. And that had a kind of that had its origins originally on the internet. People, talking about stuff, writing stuff on the internet, complaining, and creating websites. And then that kind of had that followed its organic logic. And then they started to meet up, make groups, meet people face to face. And you see some moves like that in the American New Right. I mean, groups like Countercurrents, they're trying to create meetups and various things. TRS do that, and of course with Radix they try to organize these conferences, and so there are a few small signs of this hitherto purely internet movement starting to try to move out of that into the real world. But also there seem to be countervailing forces trying to keep it purely contained within the internet.
One thing about Italy that is interesting is in their history. I mean, Italy was originally many different smaller countries, and it didn't become a country, a unified country, until the 19th century. So I think if you look at polling, like, most people in Italy, I would say, are probably, there probably is healthy, like, national sentiment.
Yeah.
And people tend, would probably, are not that crazy about the whole
invasion
going on.
Yeah, actually, you say nationalism, but there's also, with a country like Italy, because of its history, has a number of small states and communities, there's also kind of anti-nationalism, which helps nationalism, if you know what I mean.
Well, what I was getting at is that there are these kind of regional rivalries.
Yeah.
I know the Northern League, or the Lega Nord, has been very successful on a regional level, but obviously there's regional... Like, I'll give you an example, is there's kind of a joke in Northern Italy where they say that Africa begins, like, south of Rome.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there's sort of rivalries between Northern and Southern Italians.
Yeah. Yeah, there, that that kind of element of localism, I think it's actually key to whether nationalism can start to manifest itself in the real world. Because, you know, you have a group like Casa Pound, and, you know, technically they're still a very small group, but because they have a kind of communitarian focus, they're able to manifest their nationalism or their identitarianism in a much more real world sense than similar movements in countries like America. So for nationalism to manifest itself in an Anglo country, it needs to reach a much higher threshold than it does in some of these more communitarian based countries.
How much time have you personally spent traveling in Italy?
I visited Italy a few years ago, and I didn't go all around Italy. I just went to Ostia and Rome. And I spent most of my time in Rome in the middle of summer, which is, like, really, really hot.
So with Casa Pound, obviously they were named after Ezra Pound, and they have a lot of interesting views, because I know Ezra Pound was famous for being outspoken against usury.
This is a long-running thread in Italian culture and identity, because, of course, it used to be one of the mainstays of Catholicism as well. And, it's also one of the strands that fed into fascism, because, you know, fascism was an attempt to overcompensate for the inferior position of certain European countries. And a lot of that inferiority was blamed on the international financial system.
You're saying that at the time before Mussolini came to power, like, Italians felt this sense of inferiority opposed to the northern powers like England, and England was a major center of finance.
Yeah, the Italians they viewed themselves as obviously because of their culture, they viewed themselves as one of the great powers of Europe. But they felt that they were getting a raw deal compared to the British and the French, who seemed to be running the international system. Of course, one of the real problems Italy had was it unified rather late, and so it wasn't able to build up much of a colonial empire as Britain and France were. And so they took that in a different way. They thought that they were getting a raw deal, and they thought that the world was basically being run for the benefit of these old established colonial and mercantile nations like Britain and France. Well, I think the Italians are probably one of the most popular races in the world. They seem to, be liked almost anywhere. So I don't really think there's much anti-Italian feeling in Britain. I mean, during the war, we had a lot of Italian POWs. And, we set them to work on the farms, and a lot of them ended up marrying local girls.
And you also point to this example, so there was a riot in Calabria between locals and African migrant workers who were picking fruits.
Yeah, it's just one of the many causes that the Casa Pound people have decided to, you could say latch onto, but that sounds a bit negative. I mean, I think these groups have a duty to seek out allies and to seek out situations that can promote their ideas. And you know, this case in Calabria, where you have these Africans coming in, undercutting the local labor, causing social problems, making the locals feel uneasy. You know, it's a perfect example of when a society has to, in a positive way, realize who it is and seek to protect that.
So, with the sort of interest of usury, and I mean, Ezra Pound was he was American, but I think he had a much bigger influence in Italy than he did in the United States. But with some of their ideas, they talk about a social mortgage policy that seeks to create conditions where people can buy homes without paying interest on mortgages.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of their policies are very kind of third positionist, and they don't really fit comfortably into this conventional political spectrum. And one suspects that, that might even be on purpose, because you don't want to be kind of pigeonholed by your enemies. And so, one of the advantages of the third positionist viewpoint is it makes it very difficult for your enemies to attack you in a very easy way by stereotyping you as a nasty right winger. And so a lot of their policies are very kind of sympathetic to the poor. And another thing that sort of seems to fit in with this kind of strategy of cognitive dissonance is they support certain third world groups as well. They support the Karen people in Myanmar, for example. And of course, that's you think, wow, that's completely unrelated to anything going on in Italy. You know, so there is a sort of sense of moral offsetting with some nationalist groups. Now that can be seen either as clever tactics, or it can be seen as a sense of moral weakness, because you don't really feel that you can make a strong moral case by being nationalistic about your own people. Therefore, you have to talk about other oppressed groups and try to frame your group as another group which has been oppressed. And then that's a kind of way of maybe turning the left's guns against itself. But you see that also with people like in America, you have people like David Duke, and David Duke, his main focus is to talk about Jewish power and the influence of the Jews in America. But of course, that's quite a hard act to follow. You know what I mean? It's quite hard to plow that furrow, because that's going to come across as being very kind of, quotation marks, anti-Semitic. So to sort of offset the moral opprobrium that will create, he tends to be very kind of pro-Black American and pro-Palestinian as well. Sometimes there's a little element of that with these third positionist movements.
I don't know if you're sort of seen as being anti-immigration or nationalistic. You're sort of automatically pegged as a right winger, mm-hmm. but a lot of these European nationalist parties take positions that would be seen as more progressive from an American standpoint. A lot of them are pro-environment. They support some kind of a social safety net.
Yeah.
They're skeptical of corporate influence. They're anti-banker. I mean, you even see that among, Marine Le Pen, but I know you did post that article by Bay Area guy called The Radical Center on your side, Alternative Right.
Oh, yeah.
I also interviewed him about that.
Yeah, that's true. I think that the modern left is from my point of view, because I'm actually of working class background. My father was an engineer. So from my point of view, the modern left, to me, looks like a continuation of class war. And what they've done, they've sort of the middle class and the upper classes have taken over the organs of the working class movement, and they've turned it against the working class, you know, because obviously, you know, high immigration is directly inimical to the interests of the working class. If you bloat the labor force, you're oppressing the workers, obviously. So I just see that as a very kind of sinister move by the ruling elites to destroy the working class.
And I was reading a lot of Marine Le Pen's support, and she could very likely become France's next prime minister. But a lot of her support is not from those who support, or actually not from conservatives, but former supporters of the Socialist Party.
Yeah, that's perfectly, I mean, it's perfectly logical, because what you've had leftists being in favor of globalism and the mass movement of people. That is an aberration. I mean, that is against the interests of the working class everywhere. And so this has been going on. And so these people actually return into a kind of more nationalistic, protectionist outlook is entirely in keeping with the logic of the true left wing.
So, Colin Liddell, it's been an excellent show. I'd like to thank you for being on.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Robert. Thanks.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.